pushing aside part of the protective sheet to reveal the maintenance rungs going up the side. "Good call," I admitted, making to follow. The top of the ship was only about 4 feet lower than the roof of the nearest house, and a rooftop traversal was probably the smart approach. When we were both carefully crouched on the smoothly curved roof of the ship, I could see that the cyborg sentry was no longer on the town hall roof. It may even have been the same one that was now twitching under a huge porous rock. I made to clamber onto the next roof, but Warden stopped me with an outstretched hand. "Hold." "What?" "Examine the ship as best you can from here and see if it remains entirely consistent with Alice's story." I screwed my eyes shut, then opened them as wide as I could, a massively exaggerated blink. "What is wrong with you? Have I built up enough chivalry points that I can give you a little smack? Doesn't it seem rather small for a 3-person family embarking on a scientific expedition?" I eyeballed the ship. Not that I wanted to give her the satisfaction, but it did seem a little on the pokey side. As far as I could tell, it wasn't much more than a runabout, the kind of thing mainly used for transferring people and cargo from orbiting ships to planet services. It had, however, been modified for interstellar travel. "I think they must have been working from a larger science ship," I speculated. "That immediately forgot about them after they went missing? Well, it's a big universe. These things happen." I made to climb onto the next roof and leave the issue behind. Hell, my graduating class at flight school had 2 missing persons by the end of the field training course. There was a policy against sending anyone to look for them, you see. Apparently they once lost a whole class that way when a black hole wandered onto the course. I opted to stay low and lay on my stomach at the edge of the building's roof, scouting the village centre below. The maintenance cylinder wasn't far, but then there was nothing in the village that was particularly far from anything else. I hopped down to ground level, then about 20 yards of open ground to the edge of the watering hole where the cylinder had been set up. Easy enough, if there hadn't been so many murder cyborgs around, remaining stubbornly in their patrols. I'd been hoping that we'd drawn enough attention by being spotted in the courtyard that the way would be clear, but I should have realized the Malmind were too smart for that. Actually, to look at it, none of the cyborgs were distracted at all. "Huh," I said. "Why aren't any of them investigating the courtyard?" "Perhaps they put it down to a freak rockfall," suggested Warden, crouching awkwardly next to me out of refusal to go fully prone. "Or they know we're here but don't see us as a threat." "I can tell you right now that they don't see us as a threat, but they should see us as nice fresh materials for them to get their claws all over." "I don't get it." I made an attempt to shrug from a prone position. "But I'm not about to ask them to explain themselves. So what now?" I held up a finger and watched the patrolling cyborgs carefully for about a full minute before lowering the finger ceremoniously. "I'm pretty sure there's a window in the patrols, not a long one. We'll have to sprint to the cylinder, but we just have to get between it and the lake. There should be a blind spot there." "I might prefer that we stake our lives on more than just should, McKeown." "All right, then there is a blind spot," I said, trying to sound confident. "None of them are watching the lake. I doubt they're expecting the Ruggles to come retake their village in plying submarines." "On your mark, then." I waited for the opportune moment, then swung my legs off the roof and dropped the short distance to the ground. The stone floor was more loose than I'd anticipated, and I threw up a noisy skitter of gravel as I landed, but I couldn't let myself dwell. I kept the silver pillar in the center of my vision and ran, not looking around or checking to see if Warden was following. When I arrived at the cylinder unmolested, 2 things immediately became clear. Firstly, that Warden was indeed following closely behind, and that the blind spot between the cylinder and the lake was not going to be big enough to fit 2 people. I stood with my back pressed tightly against the metal, and Warden appeared in front of me, flustered from the run. I think we both realized at that point that the only way both of us would be totally hidden from sight would be if she crushed her body against mine and we started sloppily making out. We met each other's gaze, and the silence drew on, dangerously close to the point where a cyborg might turn around and spot her, if it hadn't already passed. "Kneel," she instructed. This was unexpected. "No," I replied, sweating. "I need to stand on your shoulders." "Oh, that makes more sense." I dropped into a squat and Warden swiftly stepped on, first the right foot, then the left. She was not a heavy woman, but she was still wearing tight and pointy dress shoes, presumably to match her personality, so as I laboriously pushed myself upright again, my shoulder muscles gained new appreciation for the plight of cocktail olives. "Something is approaching," advised Warden from her new vantage point.
"Ngap,"
I said in acknowledgement, gritting my teeth. Her voice lowered. "A cyborg is heading straight toward the cylinder." I couldn't move around the cylinder to see it, and even if I could, my peripheral vision was blocked on both sides by a combination of Warden's shins and the growing number of spots before my eyes. Instead, I just closed my eyes and attempted to will myself thinner. From the opposite side of the pillar, I heard heavy footfalls approaching with the terrifying perfect rhythm of a cyberzerker, scattering gravel with every creaking thump. They stopped mere feet away from our position. I held my breath and went back to the Speedstar pre-flight checklist. Ensure docking bay is clear. Activate hazard lights. Verify presence of co-pilot. Verify consciousness of co-pilot. Verify sobriety of co-pilot. From inside the workings of the column, I heard the gurgling of liquids moving around, followed by a series of greedy gulps from the cyborg. A few drops of viscous nutrient fluid landed in the dirt. Then I heard an armored foot turning on its heel, and the cyborg stomped away. Above me, Warden released a held breath. I wasn't noticed.
"You're plying work by me,"
I spat, attempting to push her feet up with my hands to alleviate the weight, and almost succeeding in giving myself stigmata.
"Can you access the signal booster up there?"
"Ah, yes, it seems like this whole top part lifts up."
"Well, plying du bebergider,"
I said. Then I concentrated, blocked out the pain, and tried again.
"Well, plying see if you can do your hacking thing before you plying nail me to the ground."
I heard a click and a squeak of hinges, and felt numerous spikes and lifts of pain as she shifted her weight around, working. By then I discovered that some alleviation could be found by digging my feet into the sandy bank of the watering hole and pushing against the cylinder as hard as I could, and soon I dug an impressive pair of furrows. By that time a minute had passed.
"You having trouble finding the port?"
I inquired.
"No, not exactly,"
she replied, her voice muffled and echoing.
"McKeown, what is this signal booster supposed to look like?"
I thought back to my war days. I'd seen them a few times, but only ever scorched and mangled and lying in the wreckage of a bombed-out Malmine stronghold.
"I think it'll be a sort of boxy thing with a bunch of spiked aerials coming off, connected to a power source by wire."
"Right," said Warden. A long pause followed. "Is there any other appearance they can take?"
"Well, what are you looking at?"
"Nothing."
"What?"
"I can see the top of something that I believe to be the nutrient tank." There were two reverberating taps that I assumed were her knuckle against the tank. "But nothing else. The entire top part of this cylinder is hollow." I let the cogwheels in my mind turn for a few seconds. Then I dug my feet in harder and pushed upward with all my remaining strength. Warden gave a little yell and fell headfirst into the cylinder's interior, kicking her legs madly. Relieved of the burden, I spun and looked around the tube.
"Track,"
I said. Then I said it a few more times with increased volume.
"It's a plying tracking decoy!"
The Malmind had come out in force. The entire street, for want of a better word, was now packed with cyborgs, in both humanoid and ruggle flavors, a dense forest of sunburned flesh, lusterless fur, and black synthetics. And every single one was staring directly at me. I popped back into the blind spot more for my own comfort than anything else, thought quickly, then jumped. My fingers fastened around the lip of the open compartment beside Warden's struggling form. My body was about as past its prime as a packet of sandwich ham 2 weeks after opening, but I could at least manage one pull-up if I used one of the feeding pipes as a foothold. The space above the nutrient tank was indeed hollow, or at least had been before I'd shoved Warden's upper body into it, and was just about large enough for me to fit my legs in. So that left me and Warden's legs perched visibly on top of a minuscule siege tower, surrounded by the horde. No member of said horde had moved. Neither were they looking at us. I knew that they tended not to look up, but one of them must have seen where we were.
"McKeown!"
cried Warden, still trying to correct herself.
I dropped and gently but firmly filled her mouth with my knee. I met her furious gaze as she sank her teeth into my jeans, then put a finger to my lips. The Malmind horde was starting to move. They were shuffling slowly around each other in a mystifyingly complicated pattern, like a choreographed dance production at a home for the elderly. When all of them had shuffled into place, they had taken the form of a rectangular block, transforming from a mob into a regiment. Then they began to move directly toward us, the two different body sizes marching with two different beats. The smaller feet of the converted Ruggles were a quick, skittering cymbal tap to underline the slower snare drum of the humanoids. Unconsciously, I had already drawn my blaster from inside my jacket. I still had enough charge to score lethal hits on maybe 4 or 5 cyborgs, assuming perfect shots to the heads or crotch reactors. Less if I wanted to hold back 2 shots to avoid being taken alive. I looked back down into Warden's unhappy eyes and consoled myself that at least my penultimate act in life would be an immensely satisfying one. The Malmind stopped. The rank of cyborgs was inches from the cylinder. I could look down and see the bald spot in between the cranial implants of the topmost soldier. I took careful aim at it, waiting for the first attempt to topple our perch. Then the horde divided itself neatly into 2, and both halves turned smartly and marched off in opposite directions, away from us and along the banks of the watering hole. Within moments we were alone, but I waited until I'd watched the entire army meet each other on the far side of the water and stomp toward the valley, out of the village. Only then did I untense myself and withdraw my knee from Warden's mouth. "That was uncalled for," she said, spitting up loose threads of distressed denim. "They've all gone," I relayed. She gave a mighty burst of effort and withdrew herself from the cylinder the way a cat does from a kitchen sink after you turn the tap on, landing on the ground in an alert crouch, scanning the surroundings. Meanwhile, I lowered myself gently and dropped onto the ground beside her. "Track," I said, to fill the silence. "I knew they didn't make their signal boosters that obvious. Should have realized." "Yes, you should," said Warden, dusting off her knees. "So where is the signal booster?" I exposed my bottom row of teeth and released a frustrated sigh through them. "I don't know. It could be anywhere. I'm a little more confused about why they didn't attack us. They must have realized we were there. They must have." Warden looked up at our little unused siege tower. "Apply logic, McKeown. If this tower was truly intended as a decoy, then the purpose of a decoy is to engage the enemy elsewhere, while your forces pursue their true agenda unchallenged." "Which means..." Although we lacked the benefit of being part of the same emotionless hive mind, Warden and I could demonstrate remarkable synchronicity at times. In this case, with no planned choreography whatsoever, both of us turned our gazes to the valley path the Malmind forces had taken, then grabbed each other around the shoulders and yelled in each other's faces, "The camp!" Chapter 21. Somehow the journey along the valley felt like it had been a lot shorter when we were leisurely walking it in the early morning cool. Running at full sprint under the increasingly baking sun made it an arduous cross-country run for which my body was even less suitable than it had been for pull-ups. I tried not to think about the rockfall traps we saw untriggered along the way. The Malmind were not as hampered by human limitations as us, and must have gone into their fastest speed lurch mode the moment they left the village, because we failed to catch up with them. And by the time we arrived at the camp, they'd already been and gone. All the possessions and sleeping equipment remained, but there was not a single sign of life, and everything was scattered and torn, as if a multitude of heavy feet had stomped pitilessly through it. The ashes of last night's fire were scattered across the ground like a comet tail. Warden and I picked through the wreckage, but we didn't find a single body, alive or dead. With the Malmind, this was about the worst possible sign. "Jemima has been taken," said Warden gravely. "Alice too," I added, punching my palm. "Yes, willingly or unwillingly." She met my gaze. I waved an arm in irritation, letting my hand flap loosely like a surrender flag. "Let's not think about that straight away. We need to know what direction they headed. Look for tracks." That was easier said than done, if we'd been surrounded by a nice sandy desert, whipped over the centuries into smooth, undisturbed dunes, then the trail would have been so obvious they might as well have paved it. But these were the rocky plains. I could just about hazard a guess that they were heading northwest, toward the cliffs that the valley opened out into, and that was only from the direction indicated by the campfire ashes.
"They cannot have gone far, McKeown," pointed out Warden.
"I know!" I put my hands on my hips and searched the horizon, but there was nothing so helpful as a rising dust cloud or neon sign. Things would be so plying different if I had a ship right now. We could spot them easily from the air. "What about Alice's ship? Could you get it working without the keys?" "Nah, can't do that." "Why not?" I was about to reply, "Because I just can't," but that didn't seem like a satisfactory answer, even to me. The truth was, I probably could get it going without keys, especially if it was an older model from before the recent updates in security measures. Pretty much anything more than 6 years old I could get inside with nothing more than stiff wire and half a tennis ball. But that wasn't the point. I just feel weird about taking it. Warden dropped the torn bedroll she was checking under. "Are you serious?" "It's a pilot thing. It'd be like wearing someone else's flight jacket. It's just, not something you do."
"McKeown!" She trotted smartly up to me and jabbed a finger into my sternum. "You may have regressed into that stupid cowboy code of honor fantasy life you used to lead, but I personally do not wish to attempt to explain that to the president when she finds out what happened to her daughter. So we are going to take that ship. Understand?"
I sheepishly backtracked out of finger-jabbing range. "All right, all right." "I know. I was just kinda hoping I could get through my entire life without breaking every single one of my principles."
"Good."
She began striding for the valley. "So," I said, jogging a little to keep up. "Having walked all the way to the village and back, the plan at this point is to walk all the way there again."
"Barring alternatives," she replied through her teeth, without slowing. "Right, what an absolute plying model of efficiency this whole operation has been."
It was rubbing up against noon by the time the village was back in visual range. We were making our way back through the valley this time, rather than along the side, for the sake of being close to the stream. This was doing very little good for my feet, which seemed to have gone up 2 or 3 shoe sizes since I'd woken up that morning.
"Stupid cowboy fantasy life," I asked, when it occurred to me to do so.
"Let it go, McKeown," murmured Warden distantly. She was probably doing even worse with those sensible shoes in this terrain, but she was courageously holding it all behind the facade of emotionlessness. Beads of sweat gave it away.
"What would you plying know?" I said, more to myself than to her. "At least we had a dream. At least we were trying to be part of something bigger than ourselves. And what was that, your ego? It was about helping the weak. It was about justice. It was about showing people less advantaged than us that they didn't have to cave in to being brutalized."
She grabbed me around the throat and slammed me against the valley wall. She wasn't strong, but the attack had caught me off guard and I lost my balance. I thought she might have been trying to make a point, but she kept me pinned there, one hand on my chest, as she peered around a nearby outcrop, a finger to her lips.
"They're in the village," she reported.
"Who are? Who do you think? The Malmind?" I edged my way behind her, inserted my head into the space just above hers, and peered around the wall. Sure enough, I could see the little black dots of Malmind cyborgs patrolling the village, just as they had been doing before. Even at this distance, they could be easily identified by the way they walked like stunned ostriches queuing up at the lunch trough.
"It's not possible," I whispered.
"And yet there they are." I let myself fall backward away from the outcrop and leaned on the cliff wall, thinking.
"There's no way they could have gotten back to the village this quickly without us noticing. Do they have much stealth capability?"
I gave her a withering look. "Warden, look at them. They move like dinosaurs with their feet trapped in buckets."
"Then the only explanation is that they must have another means of getting into the village, other than the valley path or descending from the cliffs, either of which, as you say, we would have noticed."
Even as she said the words, I could feel a couple of loose threads in the depths of my mind straining to reach each other.
"Wait a second," I said, pacing in as wide a circle as I could manage without walking out into the open.
Alice said the Malmite came out of nowhere when they first took the village. If we can trust her version of events, stop it. So if we assume they didn't attack from the front, or from above, then that leaves... My finger waggled in front of me, chopping the air up into thin slices. Yes, prompted Warden. Well. Well what? Well. In the little courtyard we rappelled down into, there was a well. Well? Yes, a well. I meant well as in where are you going with this? I stopped the waggling of my finger and pointed it skyward as I met her gaze. Why would there be a well? The village is plying built around a dirty great watering hole. They don't have any need for a well, as well. I dropped my finger to symbolize the dropping of this extremely good point. So perhaps it wasn't a well, said Warden, her speech slowing as she came around to my line of thinking. I think it was me who started running first. The pains in my feet temporarily forgotten, I headed away from the village and then took a left turn out of the valley, following the cliffs to the area that the scattered campfire ashes had been vaguely pointing toward. I almost walked straight past it when I found it, as it was naturally hidden behind a sort of S-bend of extruding rock, but the draft gave it away. There was an entrance to some kind of cavern network that seemed to slope downward under the valley. I knew it, I said as Warden trotted up to see. This is where they took the others. There must be caverns running under the village, said Warden, panting a little, and the well must have been an access point. Right. Maybe the Ruggles used them as a tomb or something. I'll bet the real Malmine signal booster is down here somewhere. And presumably also the prisoners? Surely they won't have been converted so quickly. We can rescue them. Right. I held up an open hand. High five. Stop it. Let's go. Although hard to spot, the cave entrance was surprisingly wide, enough to walk two abreast. The tunnel widened even further once we were in. I had some experience with Cantrabarjit's caves, and had always found them rather disappointing, as natural features go. I'd rarely seen one that was more than just a pathetic little crack in the side of a mountain, scarcely of use for much more than a weapons cache. But this cave was about as accommodating as they get. It was a flat tunnel that maintained a semicircular roof along its entire length, which gave credence to the idea that it was man-made, or at least Ruggle-made, but at the same time the walls were rough and the tunnel snaked weirdly. Perhaps it was a natural tunnel that had merely been widened. A short way into the tunnels, what little light came in from the entrance had faded to nothing, but we could see a glow from the corner just ahead, which we swiftly found to be coming from a series of flaming torches, marking a path that someone must have very recently taken. "The Malmind can see in the dark, I think you said?" asked Warden, inspecting a flame warily. "Yeah, so I guess if they were the ones that lit these, then we know they were moving prisoners through here." We continued, following the illuminated path. I was losing faith in the idea that the Ruggles had dug this out. It was far too big, and the torches were old, used, and placed too high for a sloth to reach. I suppose the tunnels must have predated them, and that was confirmed when we found an ancient stone casket in a recess in the wall. Well, you were half right, said Warden, inspecting it with hand on hip. Someone used these tunnels as a tomb. Rather large for a Ruggle, of course. She wasn't exaggerating. The casket would have been rather large for a family of four. Weathered lettering was carved into the side, each character about 8 inches high. Wait a second, I said, crouching nearby. I ran my fingers along the carving, finding the lines that were obscured by time and meager torchlight. I recognize this language. What does it say? When I say I recognize it, I mean I know what it is, I can't translate it. It's Zaviron. Cantrabarjit's warrior race had a famously inefficient written language. I couriered a couple of messages for them during the war. They had each weighed 2 tons and had to be carried with the winch. So I was right. This is Cantrabarjit, and this is Zaviron land. So what the hell happened to them? McKeown, said Warden, hushed and urgent. She had gone on ahead a few yards. I hear something. Just ahead. We crept to the far end of the current length of tunnel, where it opened up onto the second level of a vast cylindrical chamber,
which presumably had to be this large to accommodate the many Zaviron tributes to the dead carved into the walls. I can't imagine that the Zaviron dead would have been mollified by them now, not after their tomb had been abused into its current state. The lowest level of the chamber, below our perch, was absolutely swarming with Malmind cyborgs. Some were patrolling, some were standing perfectly still, and others were queuing politely at one of the 6 nutrient-dispensing cylinders scattered throughout the crowd. In the very centre of the floor was a sight that I only recognised from rumours. It was a tulip-shaped tower of mysterious electrical components, trailing black cables like the numerous tentacles of an eldritch abomination. At its base was a range of screens and keyboards that had much of the church organ about them, ringed by a humming server farm laid out like a druidic stone circle. "Well," I said, after swallowing hard, "now we know why they didn't need a signal booster in the village."
"Why?" asked Warden, not looking away from the spectacle.
"Because this is the Malmind Central Core, from which every Malmind unit in the entire galaxy is controlled and monitored. I heard it tends to move around a bit. I guess it's currently on Cantrabarjit."
Warden put a hand on her hip again. "Well, let me congratulate you a second time on what a thorough job you did saving this planet from them."
"It was years ago," I barked before reflexively ducking, checking and double-checking that the Malmind hadn't heard me. I continued in an urgent whisper. "What was I supposed to do? Become their king? They used to bite each other's noses off as a greeting. Doesn't seem to have helped them." I felt a pang of guilt at that, and became uncomfortably aware of the desecrated Zaviron tombs all around us. But that made me wonder why I hadn't seen any Zaviron cyborgs. It was hard to assume that the Malmind couldn't see the usefulness in a few battalions of brick track houses. Maybe they were too useful and were all off-world conquering planets as we spoke. Or maybe the Zavirons hadn't let themselves be taken alive. That seemed very them. But as my gaze, driven by my thoughts, ran along the walls of Zaviron memorials, I saw something. A little way along the elevated path that ran around the room's perimeter, I could see that several sarcophagi had been hauled out of their recesses, and the spaces were now blocked off by fizzling force fields. I caught Warden's eye and cocked a head toward it, then the two of us made our way along the path, staying close to the perimeter wall. When I reached the first improvised cell, I could almost feel the buzz from the force field generator as a physical thing sandpapering across my nerves. There must have been enough charge in it to atomize a pregnant Zaviron tribe mother. But as I peered through it, I saw a huge number of closely packed, fearful Ruggle eyes staring back from the darkness. Then there was a sudden eruption of furry bodies, and Jemima appeared, looking a little sunburned but otherwise unharmed.
"Oh my God!"
cried Jemima, almost running straight into the force field to greet us.
"They said no one would ever find us here."
"Where is Alice?"
asked Warden suspiciously, inspecting the other cells and finding only Ruggles.
"She escaped," said Jemima. "None of us have been converted because they've been busy trying to get her back."
"Escaped? How?"
Warden was inspecting the force field generators and saw as I had that they completely covered the mouths of each recess with no gaps.
"I dunno," said Jemima. "She wasn't in this cell."
"Wait a second." I displayed a finger. "Who said no one would ever find you here? Because I know Malmind cyborgs and they're not chatty."
"He did."
Jemima pointed toward the lower floor of the chamber as best she could without sticking a hand through the force field. I knew who she meant even before I looked. There was a human figure at the bottom of the control tower, so small between the huge glowing screens and components that I hadn't noticed him earlier. He was sitting in a rather ordinary wheeled office chair, his hands rattling dexterously on the many keyboards. To my own self-disgust, I felt momentarily starstruck. It was him, Malcolm Sturb, the former boy genius turned teen software mogul turned adult galactic scourge. By now he was in his late 20s or early 30s, and was of average height and average build, save for a paunch consistent with a white-collar worker, unaccustomed to exercise, but very much accustomed to having a Danish pastry with their morning coffee. He was wearing an ordinary polo shirt, slacks, and a massive ornate metal crown constructed from geometric shapes. The man who had created the Malmind, ostensibly after growing bored with VR war games, was right in front of me. The brain. The master controller. And I had a gun. I pulled it from inside my jacket to coincide with my thoughts, and my excitement rose. Jemima's bulging eyes shone out from the darkness like a pair of headlights.
"Are you sure about this? Is there any charge left in that?"
"There's more than enough," I said distantly. "And yes, I'm sure I know what would be the best use for it."
"Really?"
Jemima bit her lip.
"Are you sure you want to use it up? I mean, you might need it later."
"I'm talking about killing Malcolm Sturb," I hissed. "Ending the Malmind. The Galactic Scourge gone once and for all. I can finish the fight that I and every other star pilot have only ever chipped away at for decades. What better use are you imagining from half a charge of blaster cell?" By the end of my question, I was already turning the blaster up to solve all immediate problems and taking aim for the slumped figure silhouetted against the multiple screens. But Warden clamped a hand around my straightened elbow. "McKeown, if you fire that gun, every single hostile entity in this chamber will immediately know our position." "Warden," I said, adopting her tone of voice, "it won't matter, because all the hostile entities in the room can't do track unless the central control hub is functioning, and the central control hub in question will be spread across the floor like jam on toast." Her eyes flicked around as the cogwheels turned, then she released my arm. "Very well, proceed." I was about to, but I noticed a commotion in the cyborg mob. Sturb suddenly spun around in his office chair as his minions parted neatly. Alice was being brought forward by a pair of the humanoid cyborgs, each holding an arm. She was making up for that by getting as much motion as she could out of her legs, but they weren't touching the ground.
"Ah, yes, the native girl," said Malcolm Sturb.
I hadn't heard that he had a voice like one of those early 20th century horror movie villains.
"You are proving an annoyance again and again. Converting you first has now become a necessity."
"You can't make me keep still for it," said Alice through defiantly clenched teeth.
"I only need one minion to hold each limb," said Sturb matter-of-factly. "Unless you are hiding several thousand vestigial ones, I do not see this as an issue."
As if to illustrate his point, two cyborgified Ruggles ran up with perfect synchronicity and latched onto her shins. Even from a distance I could see the fear rising in Alice's eyes as Sturb took a step forward, toying with his fingers menacingly.
"We will be avenged," quavered Alice.
Sturb folded his arms.
"Girl, you are the only thing that even comes close to intelligent or physically threatening among that entire teddy bear collection you call a tribe. Honestly, who or what do you expect to be avenging you?"
And that sounded like as good a cue as any. I stood at the edge of the platform, spread my legs to optimal heroic pose width, took a moment to make sure I was dynamically silhouetted against the glow from the force field behind me, and yelled, "Sturb!" Every face in the room turned in my direction. I must have made for quite an impressive sight, elevated above the Malmind horde with gun drawn and legs akimbo. It was the sort of situation that called for a one-liner.
"Suck it!"
I roared, and pulled the trigger. It had been a while since I'd had a chance to fire my blaster at full power, and I'd forgotten how much of a kick it had. A roaring ball of swirling energy burst from the barrel and smashed into a mob of Malmind cyborgs like a bowling ball into pins. I saw Sturb flinch with the impact, but it had missed him by several feet. Once the moment passed, I realized that the reason I had missed so hugely was less about the recoil and more about Jemima suddenly standing next to me and pushing on my wrist with all her strength.
"Jemima," I said. "It's a real gun," she called, apparently not addressing me.
"Real gun," said Sturb, suddenly very pale and dropping his villainous accent. "You let him get this far carrying a real gun?"
He directed this question at Alice, who had been freed by the cyborgs but was making no effort to escape or fight.
"You're the one who's supposed to take their weapons away. You're the villain."
said Alice. "Excuse me," said Sturb petulantly. "It says quite clearly in the guide, if the participants are not disarmed in the first encounter, any available person should take the opportunity to do so when possible." "I didn't know he had a gun," Alice protested. She, too, had dropped the slightly alien lilt from her voice.
My legs were starting to get stiff from my heroic pose, and I still hadn't gotten my head around the situation until Warden piped up. "McKeown, look." She was kneeling by the edge of our perch, and I saw what she was indicating. The cyborgs I had fired upon were reduced to scattered, fizzling pieces on the ground, surrounded by their completely unperturbed brethren. I saw a lot of scorched servos still whirring by themselves, and a lot of mechanical body parts with scraps of waxy fake skin hanging off them. What I wasn't seeing was much in the way of organic tissue.
"I don't believe these to be cyborgs at all," said Warden. "I think they are entirely robotic."
I thought back to the first one I had killed when we'd arrived on the planet. Its insides had been far too red-hot and melted to properly inspect, but now that I thought back to it, the rubbery, dead look on its face could probably be explained by it being both made of rubber and not alive. I hopped down into my newly created smoking patch of destruction, crunching motors and gears beneath my shoes.
"Could someone please explain to me what is going on? Are you telling me that none of this has been real?"
The person I had assumed was Malcolm Sturb blustered indignantly.
"Of course it's real. This is a genuine planet-saving experience straight from the golden age of star piloting. I mean, you can forget about VR. This is realer than real."
I let him finish, counted to three, then made my point. "I meant not real in the sense that no one's actually being turned into cyborgs or in any danger at all." He adjusted his crown.
"Well, no. Not until you showed up swinging a real gun around, anyway."
I turned to Alice. "And presumably you weren't raised by slots, either." She picked awkwardly at her fur bikini and reddened.
"No, but I am classically trained."
My scowling gaze then moved to a row of cyborg Ruggles, who were still standing nearby with frozen, shocked expressions and their little arms held out. After a few seconds of concentrated glare, one of them caved, relaxed their arms, and morosely unclipped their fake cranial implant. That spurred the rest of them to do the same.
"Well, I feel like a plying chump now, don't I?" I spat. "Ruggles! You even made the name cute! What are they really called?"
"We are Spurcobulans,"
said the nearest ex-Ruggle, making me flinch. It spoke with a rather alarming voice that sounded like a death metal singer had given up his career to spend the rest of his life chain-smoking in a public bathroom.
"Deep space nomadic mercenaries," explained Alice, staring at the floor. "They do any work for pay. It's part of their honor system."
"Yeah,"
growled another Spurcubulan, producing a switchblade from some kind of pouch like a marsupial's.
"So you better not ruin this gig for us, or we'll cut you."
"So what happened to the Zavirons?"
I asked, turning back to Sturb.
"Suppose there's no reason to hide anything at this point, is there?"
He turned back to his cluster of keyboards and entered a lengthy password into one of the many competing screens. There was a whining of hydraulics, and then a large Zaviron wall painting, depicting warfare, predictably, began to rumble before sliding upward into a hidden recess and revealing a doorway marked with black and yellow stripes. And beyond that was an elongated corridor, partly lit by wall-mounted torches and partly by numerous screens and hardware bedecked with glowing LEDs. I saw row after row of workstations like scaled-down versions of the one Sturb used, and at every single one there sat a Zaviron. Each stared fixedly at a screen, with all four arms occupied with a controller of some kind. At least one of them that I could see was wearing a helmet with two cans of energy drink attached.
"Four arms, very good for working the controls," said the Sturb actor, as if that was the only thing that needed explaining. "Each of them can control two robots at once."
I recognized a couple of Zaviron warriors I'd fought alongside in the war. None of them looked physically unhealthier, I had to admit, but none of them were on their feet or engaged in a life-or-death grapple for their future, which for them was pretty unhealthy in a sense.
"Zovok," I said,
addressing someone I had last seen tying the spinal columns of two cyberzerkers into a knot, somehow without killing either. "What are you all doing here?" He didn't even look at me.
"We do what we have always done," he said through his tusks. "We fight for honour. We fight for glory."
I grabbed his naked thigh urgently. It was like slapping a beached whale, and he didn't even react. "But it's not real!"
"Honor demands that we fight and prove who is the mightiest," muttered Zovok reasonably. "Honor says nothing about having to actually be in danger as well. This way we have honor and don't lose good breeding stock."
I flung a hand back at the actors and depowered robots behind me, who had gathered to watch the whole scene passively from the doorway. "They're desecrating the tombs of your dead!"
"What need have the dead for honour?" asked Zovok. "Such sentiment is useless when Zovok is just 400 points from the achievement."
I gave up and stomped back to the Malmind chamber, not stopping until I was close enough to address Jemima, who was still crouched guiltily on the upper path. "And you knew about this?"
"Well, I figured it out after they brought me here," she admitted. "When I noticed there wasn't really a force field. It was just fluorescent tubes and a buzzing noise. They came clean and I said I'd play along."
"Why?" asked Warden, standing near her on the ledge and just as nonplussed as I. Jemima shrugged.
"It was fun."
I clutched my temples for a moment. "We are trying to get you back to Robert Blaze before the UR stomps all over his station." Jemima scowled.
"I keep telling you!"
"Robert Blaze?" said Alice, her attitude changing instantly from embarrassed guilt to urgent concern. "Is he in danger?"
"Do you know him?" asked Warden. "He's the one who set all this up," said Alice. "Gave us all these jobs."
Warden looked to me. "Is that right?" "Blaze did this," I reiterated. I felt a growing sickness in my stomach, and I returned Warden's gaze. "We need to get off this planet right now. Me and Robert Blaze are going to have words." The Malcolm Sturb impersonator touched his index fingertips together nervously.
"You're not going to get him to shut all this down, are you?"
I gave him a withering look. "Do you know, I rather thought I might." He looked hurt.
"But why?"
I splayed out my arms. "This is obscene! You've turned star piloting into a plying theme park. It's like prostitution on a planetary scale. I actually thought I was making a difference. I actually thought you were Malcolm Sturb."
"I am Malcolm Sturb," said Malcolm Sturb.
"No, I meant the real Malcolm Sturb.
I am the real Malcolm Sturb."
I scrutinized his face. I'd never met the real Malcolm Sturb in person, but I'd seen plenty of photographs, usually just above or just below words like "the enemy" and large sums being offered for reward. And the likeness between those and the man in front of me was, on reflection, uncanny. A great deal of complicated feelings started wrestling for space, like baby birds in a nest, cheeping obnoxiously. "Oh, Trak, you are, aren't you?" I said.
"Yeah, I just said."
"What the hell are you doing here?" He seemed offended.
"Trying to earn a living. Do you know how much it costs to keep a galaxy-spanning hive mind going? I had to un-cyborg most of them just to get by. There isn't as much traffic around here as there used to be. You know what I blame? Quantum tunnelling."
Chapter 22. When I was a kid, my dad cheated on my mum. Just the once. As he said at the time, it could hardly have been avoided. He was French. The solution they hit upon to patch the whole mess up was a family holiday in Looney Land, which basically did the trick and ended up being one of the happier times in my childhood. But I have a very clear memory of the journey there on the tube train, one of the most excruciating trips I've ever taken, right up there with that short-lived nuclear waste dumping contract, sitting in absolute silence for hours, with both my parents opposite each other, maintaining fixed, tight-lipped eye contact. I didn't dare to so much as ask for my colouring crayons in case the argument started again. I bring this up because I was distinctly reminded of it by the atmosphere in Alice's borrowed shuttle as I flew Warden and Jemima back in the direction of Salvation Station. Except that Jemima had taken my role, while Warden and I were both sitting with arms folded, staring straight ahead, in perfect imitation of my mum. Several hours in, I decided I was going to have to start talking about it, because otherwise I was going to grind all my teeth down to slivers. I unfolded my arms and took the joysticks, not to correct the steering, but because I suspected I would need something to grip. "Well?" "Well what?" said Warden, in the passenger seat beside me. "Haven't you got anything to say?" I said, it being the only thing I could think of to say. "Something along the lines of, I told you so?" "Since you bring it up, then yes, I did say that something seemed wrong," she said, archly taking an interest in her armrest as she did so. "I admit I didn't think we had stumbled into an amusement arcade." "I don't get why you had such a, you know, problem with it," said Jemima, in the tiny living space behind us. To my annoyance, she had insisted on leaving the Malmind lair through the gift shop, and was now wearing a bright pink T-shirt bearing the words, "I was a Cantrabarged captive." I half turned in my seat and rested an elbow on the headrest to give her the full force of my glare. "Are you serious? Did you even see what was going on down there?" Jemima gave one of those nervous quasi-smiles that weren't sure if they were going to break out or not.
"I saw a lot of things, yeah. I saw a lot of people who seemed to be, you know, perfectly happy with it all."
I turned around and got my eyes back on the metaphorical road. "Well, I'm not happy. What you saw was exploitation. It's offensive to me and the entire calling of star piloting."
"Oh, what, so you want to try to shut down something that helps people just because it offends you?"
said Jemima hotly.
"Like what my mum does with all those newspaper companies."
I kept my eyes on the view screen, but held up a single waggling finger. "It is not the same thing."
"Why?"
she insisted in that infuriating teenage way. I let the finger continue waggling for a few moments as I sought the words. "Warden, tell her." "Tell her what?" said Warden sniffily. "I agree with her that the arrangement seems to work perfectly well for all concerned. I'd rather discuss what plan we have for getting her back to her mother before the Navy arrives."
"She's not going to send the Navy, I keep telling you,"
insisted Jemima, after a tut and a sigh. "You don't know that," said Warden dismissively. Jemima stood up straight so quickly that her head sank an inch into the ceiling padding with a thunk.
"Why does everyone think they know my mum better than I do?" she raged,
before stomping off toward the toilet door at the stern.
"She's only been president for 2 years. I've had her for like 16.
She slammed the toilet door shut behind her. I heard a clank as she sat huffily down on the toilet lid. We flew in silence for another 10 minutes, me glowering at the small cluster of stars we were making absolutely no significant progress toward, and Warden pretending to be taking an academic interest in the specks of cosmic dust that drifted past. "Someone should talk to her," I said, hinting spitefully. "People only ever say someone when they mean you," said Warden. "All right, you should talk to her," I snapped. "You know how to talk to kids. You were Daniel's tutor." "Personal assistant," she said tightly, firing the syllables as if from a staple gun. "I can instruct children, yes, but I think this requires a different level of communication. I can't go back there. I'm the pilot." "I didn't mean you. If the aim is to talk her out of her arrested development, I'd rather the blind not attempt to lead the blind. Listen here, you div." The debate ended suddenly when the control console blared an alert in my face to the effect that a ship nearby had locked its weapons onto our shuttle. The view through the windshield was just the usual endless black with twinkly bits, so I flicked on the augmented reality flight aid. The view became filled with bright green lines, wrapping themselves around the contours of a fleet of ugly black attack ships, arranged in a grid that filled the view screen. More and more of the ships were locking weapons onto our shuttle, but no one was firing yet. The sleeping dragon had merely opened an eye and seen what appeared to be a fly buzzing around a turd. "What the track?" I said reflexively. "I think it might be the United Republic Navy," said Warden.
It appears that Robert Blaze and his colleagues are in something of a strawberry jam situation.
Never understood that phrase, I muttered, before addressing the toilet door. Hey, Jemima, wanna come see how much your mum doesn't care?
She didn't reply. I heard the faint sound of tinny music. She must have had her earbuds in. Whatever, I said, switching to the communication controls. This should save a bit of time. I directed a broadcast to the nearest convenient ship. This is, a passenger shuttle we borrowed. We have the President's daughter on board our ship. Not a prisoner. That part is crucial. Not a prisoner. Ready to return her when you are. Over. I put a hand on the mic and turned to Warden. Anything you want to add? I was answered by a burst of static, and then the voice of a woman, speaking with extreme measured politeness with more than a hint of eroticism.
Attention. Thank you for coming within missile range of this United Republic naval battleship. We are currently maintaining a perimeter around this region of space. Please reverse and seek alternative routes, as any attempt to encroach further will be treated as hostility. If you would like to learn more about the United Republic Navy, including current maneuvers and job opportunities, please contact...
Just one thing, said Warden. The UR Navy mostly consists of unmanned ships. I flicked the communicator off with a frustrated grunt. Right, so that was plying pointless, wasn't it? And we'll never be able to break through a naval perimeter in this thing.
There may be a gap in their coverage, suggested Warden, and there might not be. And once we've gone all the way around looking for it, it'll be too late.
The rescue fleet will have torn Salvation Station apart, looking for something to rescue. I tapped my forehead rapidly as I thought aloud, and it soon began to hurt. There's got to be someone we can call. Let them know we've got the person they're looking for. Surely you've got contact in the government.
Yes, but I threw my phone out of the airlock when I resolved to kidnap Mr. Henderson's son.
Oh, yeah, I said. And I did that too, didn't I? Not before he called me and told me about Jemima, no, but I did after that. Give me some credit. I blew out my cheeks.
Okay, then. Forget calling someone. We've got to find a way past the perimeter without being noticed.
It occurs to me that a quantunnel would be enormously useful at this point, if Blaze's people have completed their gate, said Warden. I felt the usual surge of anger I felt whenever someone suggested using a quantunnel, but managed to redirect it to a different part of my brain, and the energy boost sent a sequence of wheels turning. Hang on. We can't quantunnel. But what's the next best thing to quantunnels?
Don't milk it, McKeown. Do you have a plan?
Trebuchet gates, I said, slightly miffed. There's a trebuchet gate very close to Cantrabarjit. That's why I always used it for my charter tours. We can reach that and get launched with time to spare.
That would propel us too far, surely.
There's another crafty little hack you can do with them. Kind of like the opposite of what we did last time, I said, running the numbers through my head as we spoke. You activate the launch before it's fully charged, and you can get thrown a shorter distance with slightly more accuracy. I think I can get us within the perimeter, maybe even right up close to Salvation.
Is it safe? Asked Warden.
No, I said, having anticipated the question, although I'll be plied if I can think of anything else to do, except maybe fly all the way back to the solar system and drop Jemima off to her mother directly.
No, said Warden loudly.
No, I'm not a fan of that one either. Trebuchet it is. My wounded hand started throbbing again as we neared the Cantrabarjit trebuchet gate, and I started to wonder if going back to the solar system was actually as impossible as it had seemed. Without the chip, I wasn't legally Jacques McKeown at present, and those star pilots who wanted me dead had probably all lost interest in the matter around the time their weekly fuel bill showed up.
McKeown, said Warden suddenly.
I snapped out of my reverie.
Concentrate, McKeown, we are nearly there.
Sure enough, the rather old and poorly maintained trebuchet gate was filling the view screen, a giant metallic pacifier hanging in space.
All right, let's see if I can actually pull this off, I said, mostly to myself, as I got to work interfacing with the gate and making the navigational calculations.
So, I thought, why not go home to Ritsuko City? The fact was, I supposed, that I wanted to be here, and I wanted to save Robert Blaze. I liked the idea of a place for pilots in the universe,
What I'd seen on Cantrabarjit was making me go off his specific vision pretty plying fast, but I still wanted to save him. That and now maybe kick him in the doinks a few times as well.
"What exactly is the risk here?" asked Warden. Her voice seemed to be particularly abrasive on this occasion.
"It should be easy as long as I can stay focused."
I peered at the numbers before me, and my thoughts drifted almost immediately away again. I was in pain, tired, and coming down from angry adrenaline. My brain had thrown itself onto a mattress in a sulk, curled up, and was refusing to respond. I screwed my eyes up tight and opened them again, a technique that has never, ever worked in the entire history of man. The wall of figures I was proposing to ram our shuttle through swam momentarily back into focus, but Warden's constant staring threw me off again. I saw her glance behind her. Jemima was still in the rear toilet, listening to what sounded like theme songs from Japanese cartoons, and release an irritated sigh.
"McKeown, I think we should have sex."
I did the eye screw thing a second time, then a third, then clenched my fists. "I am trying to concentrate on this jump so we don't end up crushed up against Salvation Station's hull," I said measuredly. "That statement did the opposite of helping."
"Don't be willfully dense," chided Warden. "It is obvious that built-up frustration is affecting your judgment, and if it will ensure our survival, I am willing to make a sacrifice."
I sat back in my chair and stared at her. She had the same stiff posture and cold tone of voice as always, not exactly throwing herself into the task of seduction.
"Make a sacrifice? Oh, aren't you just plying full of the milk of human kindness?"
She curled her mouth disgustedly.
"You are physically attracted to me. It was increasingly obvious when we were being forced to work together on that planet. I'm only suggesting that we optimize our current resources."
"And you honestly think that getting within a plying light year of your current resources would ease my tension? I'd be afraid of something getting bitten off."
She straightened her back, offended. "Your embarrassment is wasting time. I am willing to brave this unpleasantness. I am only asking to be met halfway."
I gave her a sidelong look through narrowed eyes, and she shifted uncomfortably.
"Oh," I said, "I know what this is all about."
She didn't respond, although she maintained glaring eye contact. I continued,
"This isn't about throwing yourself on the sacrificial altar of my libido. You're not that magnanimous. You're the one with the frustration built up, and you're the one that secretly wants to ply me rotten."
She coloured.
"McKeown, scratch that. You just want to ply something rotten.
But you can't let yourself think that.
Oh no, that would be showing far too much emotion for the plying psycho div.
So you've got to convince yourself that you really don't want to and that you've got no choice, so that you're free to have all the dirty hate sex you want without fear of ruining your image."
She was squirming in her seat, limbs locked, and I fancied she was about to start sweating poison like a tree frog.
"What on earth makes you think that I would want to?"
She was having problems getting her mouth around the words, so I took over again.
"You brought it up, you plying nutcase. Are you like this because of Henderson? You have to build up a big wall, because if it ever cracks, he might see your weaknesses. And now everything you've suppressed is rushing to the surface and overflowing the dam, and you just thought, hey, here's this rugged star pilot over here who might be able to stick a finger in the hole to stop the leak." Actually, that was a bad choice of words.
"McKeown!"
she intoned. The straining dam had given a little squirt.
"How could I possibly be attracted to you?"
She pronounced the last three words the way one would pronounce louse-ridden. I folded my arms, springing the trap.
"I never said you were. I just said you were after dirty, consequence-free sex with whatever was convenient.
How strange that your mind should go there."
"Enough! I am not the slightest bit attracted to you. I don't even know who you are!"
I raised my eyebrows, surprised. She let out a long breath, then almost immediately drew it all back in.
"That's why I keep calling you McKeown," she continued. "Because when I went to change your name on the Chip ID network, I discovered that there were three names already on it. And not even the authorities seemed to know which one you were born with."
She slumped in her seat and turned away.
I thought the outburst was over, but then she suddenly sprang back into life like a man-trap. When I came to that spaceport, looking for a pilot, I was convinced that I would not survive to the dawn. It was my last, tiniest scrap of hope. I was going to present a random bum to Mr. Henderson and introduce him as Jacques McKeown. I was certain that Henderson would see through it in an instant, and we'd both be meat for the cassowaries. Charming. But I wasn't sure if I was more offended by her willful endangerment of my life or use of the words random bum. But then we got through the dinner, and I realized that I'd stumbled upon the perfect candidate entirely by accident. Someone who can wear any disguise he wants because there's nothing underneath. You just adapt. You become whatever you need to be. Thank you. It was not a compliment. She was practically screeching now, and her hands were bobbing madly as she sought the words. You are a cockroach, McKeown. You get dropped into a situation, and you scrape together whatever you need to survive a little bit longer. You've got no idea how to plan, how to build anything, or make something of your life. Your only conviction is the desire to live a stupid space hero fantasy. I don't understand how someone can be so adaptable and at the same time so intent on clinging to the past. She deflated a little, bracing herself on the armrests, and I thought the storm might have passed, but then recognized her posture as that of someone mid-heave during a protracted vomiting session. Sure enough, the hands came up again, and if I have occasionally found you interesting solely on some academic level, then it was only because I have never been able... Something seemed to get through to her conscious mind, and she immediately clammed up, wrapping her arms around herself and shrinking in her seat. It was like a misbehaving umbrella finally closing and snapping into place. Her eyes focused determinedly on the viewscreen in front of her. Only her beet-red complexion remained as evidence of her rant. I chewed on my lip as the silence dragged on. Then I gave a little cough. Feel better? Yes, came a tiny little voice from somewhere inside the tightly folded package of her body. How was it for you, darling? Just launch the flying ship, McKeown. Chapter 23. There was a sickening surge of turbulence, a disorienting dance of light and colour across the viewscreen, and the shuttle emerged lurchily from the short-range trebuchet jump. Salvation Station was very close. In fact, it was filling most of the view. I slammed on the braking thrusters, knowing full well it wasn't going to stop us in time, and yanked on the stick. The shuttle spun into a full turn, and we found ourselves hurtling backward along Salvation Station's armoured hull. The actual distance between the shuttle and the station was hard to determine when the viewscreen showed nothing but blurred metal plating. I thought it would be safe to bank away, whereupon one of the shuttle's fins smashed into what I supposed was one of the station's defensive turrets, and we went into a violent spin. The shuttle's artificial gravity drive kept us from being thrown around, but the spinning view brought me perilously close to redecorating the interior a lovely shade of puke. I was leaning so hard on the pitch controls that I heard a crack, and one of the screws in the control bank popped out and pinged away. Finally, the thrusters caused the spin to slow, and I went through the dance of overcompensating and counter-overcompensating. Eventually, the shuttle leveled out smoothly, and I let my muscles untense in relief. Moments later, they all tensed back up again when I realized we were heading straight for Salvation Station's main docking bay, upside down. We'd slowed significantly, but not enough to stop us from passing through the force field and falling into Salvation's internal gravity. The shuttle's roof hit the floor of the docking bay, and that was all we saw through the view screen as we skidded gradually to a halt, throwing up sparks as we went. I could feel the fins smashing through numerous loose objects, which my imagination decided must be the legs and torsos of numerous innocent bystanders. Then we stopped, and the shuttle rocked back on its curved roof, letting us see the docking bay properly. It was the same one that we'd arrived in the last time, but it was now completely deserted but for a handful of ships. We'd been ploughing through crates that seemed to have been prepared for loading. There was a beep as the shuttle liaised with Salvation's internal atmosphere, and the gravity was switched to match the rest of the station. The ceiling immediately became a floor, upon which Warden and I landed in a pile. "How very smoothly done, McKeown," said Warden from somewhere underneath my left leg. "No, I guess you were right," I said, still groggy from the trebuchet jump. "We probably should have plied each other senseless first." I struggled out of the knot of limbs and managed to get upright, then made for the airlock door. The toilet slid open and Jemima crawled out, looking rather green about the gills. She looked up at me blearily as I struggled with the airlock door handle. "Upside down," she mumbled. "I knew that," I replied, turning it the other way. Once out in the docking bay, I could confirm that it was almost completely deserted. One or two technicians and pilots were coming and going via the main access to the concourse, hastily dropping supplies near the parked ships, but that was all. They must have noticed our entrance, but they appeared to be far too occupied to care. They glanced only briefly at the crates we had destroyed during our landing. The next thing I noticed was the Platinum God of Whale Sharks, which was squatting on a parking space in the corner like a huge fat dog sitting somewhat alert. A freshly brushed dog with a brand new collar, because repairs had been made to the damaged hull and nacelle. The breeches were patched to a semi-professional standard, and the entire ship had been recently spray-painted a vibrant red. I was walking slowly up to it, brow furrowed and jaw slack, when I heard a familiar voice call one of my names. "Mr. McKeown, you're back!" Daniel was there, clutching a small box of what looked like souvenirs, which he immediately set down so he could scamper over. "Did you win?"
"What?"
"Mr. Blaze said you had to go off for a while to fight evil and right wrongs." His eyes were shining. I noticed he'd discarded his silver jumpsuit in favour of a brand new flight jacket adorned with Salvation Station logos, which was at least slightly less pretentious.
"Is all the evil finished, then?"
"Working on it," I said, distantly. "Where is Mr. Blaze?"
"Jemima!"
shrieked Daniel, noticing his crush appear from the inverted shuttle in the background. Without even a glance back at me, he trotted straight over to her, screeching to a halt the moment he was in the 3-foot hover radius.
"You missed everything! Mr. Blaze fixed our ship, and he's been teaching me how to fly it. It's actually really easy."
"Daniel!" I shouted, loud enough to echo around the docking bay. He gave a little jump and returned his gaze to me. I said, "Where is Mr. Blaze?"
"Oh, he's just outside," said Daniel,
gesturing to the doors that led to the station's main concourse.
"He's really worried about something. He keeps trying to get people to leave."
I passed into the concourse and saw Blaze immediately. He stood addressing a small group of his crew as others hurried past in both directions, carrying crates. He gave a steady stream of orders in his reassuring voice, without barking or forgetting to say please, although his shoulders were hunched and his eyelids were heavy with exhaustion. He noticed my appearance almost immediately. His eyebrows went up and the lower corners of his mouth pulled away from his teeth in a smile that anticipated an awkward conversation. He extended a half-open hand. "Mr.... I punched him. Grabbing his proffered hand and pulling him forward added considerable stopping power to my flying fist, which sent him right onto his back, bleeding from a split lip. But I kept holding his hand, and once he was on the floor, I transitioned his weakening grip to my wrist and showed him the bandage he had given me. "What was all this about?" I said, pointing. Not having improved my ability to come up with spontaneous, dramatic one-liners.
"You have every right to be angry," he said, with some difficulty.
A couple of technicians would